my goodness. Okay. So what you've described, I'm worried that my narcissistic ex, let's make it the husband at this point, is going to turn my children into narcissists. So therefore, I'm going to focus on my victimization and co-parent from that point of view, which is also narcissistic. So my children are getting narcissism from both ends if I don't change.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, talk about, yeah, if you don't focus on the kids, then so now you're going to spend the rest of your life arguing over who made our kids a narcissist.
Hey, this is Diane Dirks.
And I'm Rick Voiles.
We've been working with co-parents in conflict for more than two decades. We've taught classes, written books, counseled parents, empathized, and agonized a few times to help people make sense of their complicated families.
We were talking one day, and it occurred to us that helping the most difficult cases comes down to one simple concept. Is one parent willing to let go of the tug-of-war rope, or is it worth it to hold on and fight?
So we invite you to take this journey with us each episode as we tackle the questions, should you hold on or let it go?
Welcome to Co-Parent Dilemmas, where we give you practical solutions to those impossible co-parents. And we're back, Diane.
Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you?
Impossible.
Impossible. The worst really, of the worst.
You really emphasized impossible.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, we're going to talk about impossible today.
Yeah.
And then we're going to talk about the possible. So,
well, of course, if there's the impossible, it's hopeless unless we can have some way to address it exactly. With the possible.
Exactly.
Because then we're just trapped and doomed.
Yes. Before we get to that, I had a funeral for Whoopi. She passed away.
Oh.
So it was a short funeral.
Who was in attendance?
Just me and the shovel.
Mr. Shovel and Mr. Dirt.
But I got a brick and I painted a goldfish on it and I made a little tombstone for
yeah.
her.
Yeah. Oh, that's sweet.
So anyway, but the good news is, and you know how when one goes, another one is born.
Uh-huh.
I was out cleaning my koi pond the other day, about a week ago. And I have a, what's called a box filter, where it contains filter material and you have to take it out and clean it out and, you know, rinse out the filter material every once in a while. And I see this little orange and it's a little baby fish.
Sucked into the filter?
Yes, a little baby goldfish was caught in the filter material.
Alive still?
Yes, alive.
Oh my goodness.
So I got so excited. And I was like, this is Whoopi too.
Oh, and traumatic entry into life.
Exactly.
Holy cow.
So I took her out and I brought it in the house and put it in the aquarium. And she's
the nursery.
She's now thriving. Interestingly
nice.
Enough. See, even fish need good child development.
Yeah.
Put her in the aquarium and she did not know how to come to the surface to eat.
Interesting.
I would, you know,
no socialization.
Fish. Right. Well, she was never taught. She
right.
Didn't have any, she had no parenting. So when I would, you know, put the fish food on top of the water, and like most fish come to the surface to eat, she would just go hide. And then I'd have to swirl the water around to get the food to circulate. And then when she saw it come down, she ate it. So it's taken me about a week to get her to understand that when I turn on the light to the aquarium and she sees me, that that means food is coming.
Yeah.
So I am in the process of helping this developmentally delayed goldfish
oh,
to
dear.
Learn skills to
wow.
survive, to learn basic survival skills.
Well, good thing she was adopted by you.
I always end up with these misfits, you know, but that one just threw me off. I had no idea that a fish could get caught in that filter box.
Oh, the poor thing. Could have died in there.
It could have, but it did not. And that was, to me, Whoopi resurrected. Whoopi has now reincarnated into this other little goldfish. So anyway, what are we going to talk about, Rick, today?
Let's talk about narcissism.
Oh,
the impossible impossible.
Can we not and say we did?
No, we need to talk. So
why should we talk about narcissism today? What is significant about today, Rick?
Today?
Coming off of what you and I both did on Friday.
Yes, we both attended a webinar. We didn't know the other one was going to attend. Yeah.
We were both trying to get material for the podcast, right?
I was just trying to be a better PC. The narcissism in the age of I.
So why are we talking about this today? I think I'm talking about it, and I'll let you say what you are, but I want to talk about it today because I spend a lot of time on social media and I see a lot of anger about narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of armchair psychology around narcissism.
Yep.
There's a whole lexicon of jargon developed now. Now, you know, the gaslighting term, the love bombing term. Gray rocking. So you see, and none of those are studied academic therapeutic terms.
No, they're armchair, definitely.
Yeah, those are the people that decided they were going to write a book about their own experience and they created these terms. And there's nothing wrong with those terms if you relate to them and it describes something you've been through. So it bothers me, though, a little bit that people jump on a bandwagon around narcissism and then convince others that the problem's not you, it's always them.
Okay.
Which promotes a whole other form of narcissism.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. A narcissistic victim? Is that going to be? Okay. Yeah.
If I can convince you that your partner, your ex-partner is a grandiose narcissist, I can almost turn you into a covert narcissist.
Oh, there's
virtue of you feeling like you are the only victim in the world.
Right. Or the worst. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody understands me. So I kind of, and I don't know if this will make any difference, but I think it's important to talk about narcissism conceptually and from a true mental health perspective. And I guess I want two things from our listeners today: to try not to box everybody in, including yourself, because it's complicated. Mental health disorders are always complicated because they can happen in conjunction with other mental health disorders. And, you know, we, all of us in the profession are always cautioned and warned that you always, you know, look at the comorbidity or you always look at the differential diagnosis,
right,
before you narrow it down to an absolute diagnosis. So I just think it's important that we, as we go forward, and I guess maybe for my own integrity, that I don't want to get mixed up in the armchair psychology of narcissism.
Okay, sure.
I want us to be more vulnerable in that we talk about it from a truth perspective and challenge our listeners to not just blame the narcissist, but look at your own behavior.
Right. Okay. Because
that is what's really going to be important to your children. And by the end of this episode, I think that's really where our focus is going to be is, how do we want to answer that question? Will my child be a narcissist because his or her other parent is a narcissist? And my answer right now is it depends. And it depends on what we're going to talk about at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
And after you went to the seminar on Friday, what do you want to communicate to our listeners?
Well, I think What was most fascinating to me was the American social cultural dynamics that is literally feeding narcissistic behavior. Yes. Amongst our youth in particular, but anybody that's exposed to the American culture is being exposed to these narcissistic tendencies.
And if you think about this, if we allow our American media culture to parent our children,
oh my goodness,
then you might as well just check off that box that your child's gonna
here they come
if they don't get any intervening from you. And so I would say the same thing about their other parent. You know, it can create a problem, but it doesn't have to be the problem that you think it will be, as long as there is intervention from,
you know,
the healthier parent.
You know, this, what influence can I have to make a difference, which is why it's possible. That's what we're talking about. But we're almost talking about, so usually narcissism, we talk about neurological, psychological, mm-hmm. and untreatable dynamics of a personality disorder. But now, after this seminar, I'm really thinking more about a narcissistic incubator where we're literally nurturing, like Whoopi too. We're literally nurturing and parenting people to be narcissists. And we're right in the middle of this incubator that's producing all of this. And if we don't do something productive or positive or practical, then
And the irony is, unbeknownst to you, as a voyeur of all of this social media jargon about narcissism, you become the victim and i.e. a narcissist.
Right. You start to, because of the very medium itself. Exactly. It is fascinating.
It's very fascinating.
This workshop was fascinating.
Yes. So I want to begin just with some basics. Let's say we have a listener who has no idea what narcissism is, what it means. It's a word that comes from an old myth of the Greek. I think it's Greek. Is it Greek mythology?
Yeah. Yep.
Of Narcissus, the person's name was Narcissus, who looked into the water and saw a reflection of himself and fell in love. And that's sort of the root story of the word narcissist. But I want to start with personality in general. And the American Psychological Association has a definition of personality that I'm going to read. Personality refers to the enduring characteristics and behavior that comprise a person's unique adjustment to life, including major traits, interests, drives, values, self-concept, abilities, and emotional patterns. Various theories explain the structure and development of personality in different ways, but all agree that personality helps determine behavior. So I've always said to my clients and children that I've counseled, personality in large part is inherited, because there's no way that, I mean, you are going to inherit certain mannerisms, traits, ways of being just biologically. But that coupled with nurturing and the way that you were brought up and the examples in your life, you also are going to take some of that on, correct?
Right.
But I think one of the things I learned in this seminar as well, or I think I already knew, but it was validated. A lot of what we heard, we knew, but was validated, was that kids will also learn strategies of power.
Oh, of course.
So, you know, so just because you have an inherited personality or several inherited personality traits does not make you just like the person you inherited them from. It makes you have some traits, but how you use those traits determines character.
Yes.
So I can have the same personality traits as my narcissistic parent, who may be very outgoing. So I would say extroversion versus introversion is probably an inherited trait, would you say?
Yeah, I would say.
Sort of your way of being.
Mm-hmm.
How you process information maybe might be an inheritable trait. Just so there are certain things that you could identify and say, well, I'm like my dad or I'm like my mom because we like the same music or we have the similar interests or this is how we deal with people. We're kind of the same way. But when it comes to those power dynamics and the socialization that you received and the parenting that you receive, to me, that's when you start to develop traits to strategize and how to get what you need and want out of life.
Yeah, how to respond and survive, right?
That's when it's no longer biological, then it becomes more sociological.
Yes, or nurture.
Or relationship related. Yes. So that's where it gets so complex. And we've talked about this. I think we talked about it in our episode about gaslighting, that a child will possibly utilize strategies that he or she sees their other parent use against you. Mm-hmm. And the light bulb goes off and they go, well, that works for dad. I'm going to try that too.
Right. Absolutely.
The problem is if that works enough for a teenager, it could become hardwired for their future relationships.
It could.
Could be. So they've got to have the experience where that wiring gets crossed now and then and gets confused.
Which yes.
is a good thing, right?
Yes. Hence the concern, oh my gosh, my ex is going to turn my children into narcissists.
Right. So that's just, we're talking about personality, you know, in general. Now let's talk about what is the narcissistic personality? And you and I have said this before, but we all have narcissistic tendencies of self-focus in us. If we didn't, we wouldn't survive. You have to be
sure
somewhat self-focused.
Yes.
You know, if I didn't, most of you, if you didn't get up and go to work and provide for yourself, you would not survive. So we have to have some narcissistic traits in us in order to survive. So in that, it's not a negative.
It can be positive. Which he talked about in terms of you've got to have a healthy level of self-love or self-focus. But in our culture, we have this stigma against selfishness. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to be selfish. And then we end up becoming codependent by caring for everyone else but ourselves. But at some point, I mean, if somebody shoves your head underwater and you don't have oxygen, you're going to have to be selfish. If you're going to get that oxygen, you can't think about, oh, I wonder if the person above who's pushing my head under the water has good motives.
Yes.
You're going to have to fight and scratch and hurt people in order to get what you need. That's healthy. That's not, that's self-love that is not selfish, but we confuse it.
Well, and that's a really good analogy, Rick, because from the narcissist's point of view, saving their self-esteem is like being underwater and not being able to breathe.
Oh, wow.
And that's where it becomes skewed. Mm-hmm. So let's, for a minute, not use the word narcissism. Let's use the word self-focus.
Okay.
Because if you interchange narcissism with self-focus, what you get is we would all agree that there has to be some amount of self-focus in order for us to survive.
To be healthy. Yep.
And we know plenty of people who don't have good boundaries and they focus on everybody else and not themselves. And then they get hurt a lot. And then they end up in our offices going, you know, why does my life always go this way? And we usually have to identify because you have no boundaries. And so,
yes,
because they feel like if they set a boundary, it is selfish.
Yeah.
When really, when you set a boundary, you are telling somebody else, this is who I am. So they know how to respect you.
Yes.
So if we look at self-focus on a continuum from a little bit to way too much, that really is what determines the disorder or the dysfunction. So if we would just say for the sake of talking about it, anything probably up to that middle line of the continuum is probably fairly healthy.
Yes.
When someone starts to go beyond that middle point, moving up that scale where they need more and more and more self-focus, that requires them to diminish the other person. And the more the focus needs to be on me and less on you, the higher you go up that scale, the more dysfunctional it becomes. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So then there's this issue of self-esteem. One of the things that they said in the seminar was that self-esteem and narcissism are inextricably and bi-directionally linked.
Yes. That's nice.
What do you think that means, Rick?
Well, yeah, you can't talk about narcissism without also talking about self-esteem.
Yes.
And if I'm going to have a low self-esteem, so let's talk about self-esteem as self-love. Dysfunctional self-love can go positively or negatively. Negatively, it means I suck, right? That's a dysfunctional self-love. I could do it the opposite way, have dysfunctional self-love in that I'm the greatest person on the planet. Neither one of those are healthy. So bidirectional, it's going to go one way or the other. And that grouping in the middle is healthy.
Right. So narcissism is that self-focus, what drives somebody to that extreme self-focus is connected to their self-perception.
Yes.
And what they need to do to nurture that.
Mm-hmm.
And they take all of their cues from the external because somewhere internally, they missed that part of development.
Yes.
Somewhere internally, they didn't develop an internal sense of I'm good, I'm okay, I'm worthy. That somehow they got to adulthood and that space is empty.
Yes.
If that space is empty in me, the only way I can feed my self-esteem, which is attached to my self-focus, is to ensure that other people approve of me, to mm-hmm. ensure that other people put me on a pedestal, to ensure that other people feed my sense of self. So if we think of it in those terms that they constantly need other approval, what happens is they tend to surround themselves with shallow people because they themselves are shallow.
Uh-huh.
And people that will glom onto them because of where you might take me. So I think of politicians a lot in this role.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of people glom onto them, follow them, people that want to be led, because as long as I'm hanging on the coattails of this great person, that makes me great too. And the person in that leadership role is happy to have them until somebody challenges me. If one of the people leading me has more of a brain than I thought they did, and they're not as shallow as I thought they were, or I lead them down the path of destruction and their own internal value system kicks in and says, wait a minute, that's illegal. I don't think I'm going to do that. Then what does the narcissist do with that person?
They have to destroy them.
They annihilate them mm-hmm. emotionally.
Yep.
And this happens in relationships all of the time, as long as, you know, and dating relationships. Think of how good you feel when you start dating.
Oh, you're that
on
dopamine.
Top of the world.
Right. Like, oh,
you just think each other are the greatest thing ever. And then the normal relationship mm-hmm. goes through that infatuation period. And then you enter into the growth period where you start to learn about their little idiosyncrasies that aren't so cute anymore. And you realize, oh, I'm with a real person. For the narcissist, that period of infatuation is their lifeline. And they're deceived every time into thinking this person loves everything about me. I'm the greatest thing to this person. Until I say, hey, can you pick up your socks off the floor? Because I really don't want to see them on the floor. Or can you, you know, take me out on a date Friday night because we don't spend any time together. As soon as they hear a critical word, the wound is so deep that they then begin to either have to gaslight you to make you think that didn't happen the way you thought, which changes history. So they either have to change history or they have to beat you into submission somehow, either emotionally or maybe even physically.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cycle of abuse begins. I am going to put you in your place. Then when you get in your place, I will, what they call love bombing, which is part of the abuse cycle that's been around for years, but we've never used that term, but that's the term that is used now. As soon as I get you back into place, then I am going to send you flowers and I'm going to tell you I'm sorry and oh, I'll do better next time. until you have a need again. And you say to your narcissistic partner, I have a need, and you're not filling it.
Right.
Which creates another narcissistic wound, which starts this cycle all over again. So when you got involved with that person, you thought you were valuable. But what was really valuable is how you made them feel.
Yes.
There wasn't much value beyond that. That's why it's so shallow. So that's kind of the basics of narcissism. Let's talk a little bit then about your responsibility or reaction when you have a narcissistic co-parent.
Okay.
I think I've already said there's not much you can do as a reaction when you're a co-parent. If you're living with it and don't want to live with it anymore, then you can leave it. And that's probably the most severe reaction or action that you can take. And we say that to a lot of people. You've already set the ultimate boundary. You've divorced them or you've left them. The ultimate boundary has been set. There's not many boundaries beyond that that you can set other than you do you. Mm-hmm. And you do a darn good you. Because if you're not in touch with who you are as an individual, you're going to have trouble continuing to set boundaries with the other parent.
Yes.
And likely that's going to require some individual therapy.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. Would you say, I would say, yeah.
When you come out of any abusive relationship, whether it's emotional or sexually or, you know, physically, you have lost you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've done some of that work with people coming out of abusive relationships. And when they come into therapy, I have one question. Are we either going to get you back to where you used to be, or have you ever known that person? And do we need to discover who you are? Because some people come into therapy and say, this is how he or she made me respond was not me at all. That is, even my friends and family said, what has happened to you? You don't seem to have any sense of self-worth left. I mean, they've pretty much just hollowed you out, right?
Yes.
But they tell me, I remember who she was, and I want to get back to who she was when she was strong and confident and had a great job and enjoyed life. And okay, we'll get you back there. There are other people that I've counseled who come out of a narcissistic relationship, but they've been in serial narcissistic relationships, maybe even from childhood. They have no idea who they're supposed to be.
No, or how to be. Right.
Right. People that had no opportunity to develop a real sense of genuine self are prime targets for the narcissist, right?
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Because basically I can do whatever I want with you and shape you however I want to shape you, and you're very shapeable.
Mm-hmm. I really like your comment about the you do you.
Yes.
Because you've been in a place of dysfunctional self-love, and that where you have actually practiced a dysfunctional self-love, and now you get a chance to be a healthy self-love and develop that. But in a toxic co-parent relationship, they're still trying to hollow you out. And if you keep thinking about, well, how do I deal? How do I respond? How do I change that other person and focus on the other parent, or even focus on what that's still doing to you, then you lose your chance to do you, to be that self-love, to learn that self-love in a healthy way.
Right. And if you think about the concept of boundaries, boundaries are different in every relationship, depending on the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I have different boundaries with my husband than I do with my children. I have different boundaries with my children than I do with you as my co-host. I have different boundaries with you than I do with my other friendships. Every relationship requires a different set of boundaries depending on what that relationship looks like.
Yeah.
But for a narcissist, there's an on and off switch. Every relationship is either on,
it's the same,
or
yes,
off,
right?
You are either the greatest person in the world, and I love you, and I'll do anything for you as long as you're feeding my self-esteem, or you're dead to me.
Yep.
The problem with intimate relationships, especially when it includes children, the law doesn't allow you to be dead to me.
Yes.
because we share children. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yes. My.
So since I'm not allowed to declare you dead to me, I have to do everything I can to continue to make you a shell of yourself and annihilate you and control you. And I will now threaten to hurt the kids.
Yes.
In order to do that.
Take the kids away from you and us live as though you're dead or invisible.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's what's so scary about dealing with a narcissist who is high on the self-focus continuum. I will virtually do anything to save myself.
Yeah.
And I want co-parents who are dealing with the narcissist to look at it this way. It's kind of how we look at people that have borderline personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
People with borderline personality disorder have a huge, huge fear of abandonment, and every emotion they feel is heightened. And you can either hate them for that, or you can feel extremely sorry for them that they live that kind of life.
Mm-hmm.
That a small, what would be a small thing to the normal psyche is a huge wound.
Yes.
In them, to the point where they can't absorb it and live with it. And then they act out because of it, right? I think of this way with the narcissist, and I love the analogy you started with being underwater. You would think that they would die for their children.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would, but they would first save themselves.
Yeah, as long as it made them look good, they would.
I mean, yeah, well, yeah. That's what I'm saying. I'm talking about emotionally. I don't want to ever say that someone wouldn't run into a burning building for their child, because I think most of us, our initial instinct would be to do that. But I'm talking about emotionally. I am more likely to use my children for my own purposes.
Yes.
Than I am to deny myself for their purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And to them, it would be like drowning and not being able to breathe, to not be able to fill themselves with some external purpose. That's how strong it is.
Yeah.
So you can hate it. You can want someone to punish it. You can want them to be jailed for it. You can have all of those desires. But when it comes right down to it, you have to recognize it is so strong that they can't even see it.
That's important, because we hear all the time, why can't they just do the right thing? They can't.
They can't. The pattern is, I save myself and I always seem to come up for air. And I don't look at the dead bodies in the water around me.
Mm-mm.
Because none of that is as important or as consequential as me being able to come up for air.
So I guess practically speaking, we're suggesting that if you've got that narcissistic co-parent, there's nothing you can say, nothing you can do, nothing you're going to write, no court case you're going to file that is going to change that situation with them. But you need to be focusing more on healthy development of doing you, being you.
Yes. Hey listeners, we've got some exciting news. Starting March 6th, I'll be hosting Hump Day Help every Wednesday at noon Eastern Standard Time via Zoom. Each Wednesday will be focused on a specific topic. The first Wednesdays of the month will focus on parental alienation. The second Wednesdays will focus on parents dealing with false allegations. The third Wednesdays will be about surviving a narcissistic co-parent. And fourth Wednesdays, confronting post-separation control and abuse. You can come to one or all. The only requirement is that you become a Patreon non-impossible VIP. The cost is only $10 a month, but I guarantee you'll get your money's worth out of these support groups. We'll run them through the end of May, and if attendance is constant, we'll continue through the summer. So get started today with Patreon. The link is in the show notes. So that's part two. The second part of this, the first part was, you know, defining what a narcissist is. Your response has to do with you and setting good boundaries, especially once you're divorced or separated. Boundaries become very simple in that we will follow that court order and we'll use the email protocol, right, Rick?
Right. I mean, yep.
You know,
that's the foundation.
That's your responsibility.
Yep.
The third and most important piece is the children.
Yeah.
You have a great responsibility in helping your child to not develop the same coping skills as the narcissist is modeling for them, especially with you.
Yes.
Which is why the individual therapy and understanding where your boundaries are and setting them are so important, because kids learn by what we do, not just by what we say. They're watching. And I would even go as far to say is if you can't take the focus off of how the narcissist is victimizing you enough that you can focus on your children, I might declare you as a narcissist as well.
And that's what I learned from the workshop, that the person who, so he talked about it in terms of exceptionalism, that the narcissist sees themselves as exceptional. Well, you can see yourself as exceptionally amazing, mm-hmm. or you can be an exceptional victim. And he talked about some of the illnesses and medical examples he gave. So the person who is constantly focusing on what the narcissist is doing to them and why can't someone stop this can also be called a narcissist.
Yeah. In fact, the DSM-5, which is the Bible for diagnostic mental health disorders, only lists criteria for a narcissistic personality disorder on the grandiose subtype.
Yes.
Not the covert victimization subtype.
He called it the vulnerable covert side.
And
yes.
I think the guy's name was Ben, what?
I can't remember.
Ben Hunter.
There we go.
Dr. Ben Hunter. So I'm going to put links in the show notes to Dr. Ben Hunter, who is the one who put the seminar on, as well as Skyland Trail, which is the mental health facility in Atlanta.
Yes.
Sponsored the seminar. So let's wrap this up talking about the importance of nurturing your kids. One of the things that was, I thought, encouraging was that adolescents, well, all kids, we know, are high on the narcissism scale, right?
Yeah.
They're very self-focused, self-indulgent. They're supposed to be. What happens is as they mature, they begin to learn about relatedness. They begin to learn about the importance of others' needs over their own, and they also begin to feel the rewards of that. So, you know, let's say around the holidays, when you encourage your children to buy a special gift to the other person and they watch that other person open it and their eyes light up, and, you know, that creates something in them that says there's a joy in meeting other people's needs.
Yes, but, that I can create joy.
Right. But think about a narcissistic parent who's not able to give their child that affirmation,
mm-hmm.
because it takes away from their own sense of self. And if a child gets that enough, they don't ever learn the joy of what it means to give to others. They begin to retreat. They begin to descend into themselves, and it, the grandiosity is what is, seems to be the only thing that feeds them.
Yeah.
Is themselves. If no one else primarily in my life is feeding my self-esteem with the good stuff, I have no choice but to convince myself that I'm good. And
yes.
So those grandiose ideas begin to formulate, correct?
Everybody else creates joy for me.
Yes, right. So the 12 to 18 year range is when they're struggling with identity formation, identity confusion. You know, now in our current culture, we have many things to be confused about.
Oh, you know? Man.
And it's almost too much. Too much information, too many. I think we've given teenagers so many possibilities.
Yeah.
That they, you know, we need a happy medium somewhere. And I think the pendulum has gone from one extreme now to the other, that I can be anything I want to be, including, you know, 100 different labels. That almost promotes narcissism, because part of narcissism is infinite possibilities in my mind. He talked about that in the seminar. A narcissist might struggle with, do I become a lawyer and doctor because I know I'm smart enough to be both?
Right, I could be anything.
Maybe I should be both.
Yes.
Maybe if I'm both, then, you know, because I'm so great, I could be king of the world. But if I'm president of the United States, that might diminish my power, right?
Yes.
So if you think about how that our culture also feeds narcissistic thought in that the possibilities are infinite, mm-hmm. what I could claim that I am or say that I am. And they're already confused based on their developmental stage. I would submit that is part and parcel the reason for the high rate of teen suicide.
Yeah.
Is that it cannot identify who I really am. And so I would submit to parents in general, but especially to co-parents who are worried about the narcissistic other, is that it's healthy for you to put boundaries around your teenagers. It's healthy for them to see that although the world wants me to be everything and anything, it's good for me to honor them, honor their personalities, honor their wants and desires, but also within limits. I've always been the parent who said, there's a field of freedom. There's a fence around that field because kids can't handle there not being a fence. And so I remember the teenager who came to me and we were talking about some of her issues. And she said, well, I've been smoking a lot of pot lately. And I'm like, okay. She said, mostly because my mom lets me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
She said, I wish my mom wouldn't let me because, and the way she described her mom was trying to be the cool mom.
Yeah.
And if she was the cool mom, then she might not want to go live with dad.
Right.
But here's this girl was 16 and she sat in my office saying, I think I need my mom to tell me no.
Because yes.
I'm realizing I'm high all the time and I don't have any motivation. I don't want to do my schoolwork. I go to school and I'm like, what? Because, you know, I'm constantly under the influence of THC and that might not be the best thing for me, but I don't know how to not do it because, of course, her friends are pressuring her and she can't say, well, my mom says no. So there's no limit.
Yep.
And even in her, and as she was a maturing teen, she was realizing that no limits is not good for me. So it's up to you and your values, what those limits are, obviously, what you want to teach your child about your values. So that's completely up to you. But there has to be some sense of safety within boundaries for the children. So that might be looser boundaries than the other parent has because the narcissistic parent, because they're so black and white.
Yeah.
That you have to do this. You have to go to church with me on Sunday morning, dress up like I do to show everybody that we're great Christians or whatever. You may decide in your home, I'm not going to demand that. We'll stay home and do a Bible study together because what really matters to me is that I want to teach my child Christian principles.
You're right.
Right. So, and I'm not saying that you always counterbalance. There are things you don't counterbalance on. You know, both parents ought to say no drugs in school or, you know, curfew at midnight or whatever. You know, you, again, you do you. But understanding what the child is receiving on the other end and what they really need from you is vitally important.
Vitally.
Yeah. What are they not getting over there emotionally that I need to provide over here?
But there's also a risk in doing that because, again, I become focused on what the other parent, the power of the other parent, almost strips me of my power. If I could work on, and like you say, it may take some therapy, if I could work on who am I, me be me, and I model that and learn skills for nurturing that in my child, then what the other parent is or is not doing isn't as important.
Yeah, that's a good point. No, I agree with that. I think where it becomes maybe important is some narcissists set extremely rigid boundaries for a purpose.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But then they'll set no boundaries if they want to be the favored parent.
Oh, yeah.
You right. know what I'm saying?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So there is value in knowing what their experience is like there.
Mm-hmm.
That if the boundaries are so rigid that the child has to have a certain haircut, they're only allowed to wear these expensive designer shoes, and they, you know what I'm saying, to build some sort of weird image that they have to get straight A's or else. knowing that is valuable to you to know how to build in your child a sense of self-acceptance.
Yes, no matter that, wow, yeah, with or without those.
No one else really cares about what shoes you wear.
Right, right.
But you don't say that in the context of your dad is crazy. You don't have to listen to him. You just live it.
Yes, live it.
You just live it. Yeah. But I think the information is valuable, but I agree with you. You don't, your behavior isn't dependent on that information.
Right. And in this way,
to consider.
And in this way, it's almost helps you be you, do you, and model for your children a healthy self-love if the other parent is doing it in a dysfunctional way. Yeah. So you actually have a contrast where like the child can grow up. Well, I don't want to grow up and be that, but I do have this other model available to me.
Yes.
Yep.
So I think what's important to know to answer the question, will my teenager turn out just like his dad or mom because they're a narcissist? The answer is it depends on how much you are able to teach them your value system. And that requires you to get the focus off of yourself as a victim and onto your children as, you know, I'm nurturing and parenting them and disciplining them in a way that allows them to have value, self-value, right?
Yes.
We also know, and this was talked about in the seminar, that there is still time in those teen years to shape their personalities, to shape their character. And that way they're very much like toddlers.
Yes.
They've kind of done that reframe or defrag of their brains, and they've gotten rid of things they weren't using, and now they're taking on some new skills, and this is a great time to teach them, not by lecturing, but by responding.
Yeah.
When the child comes home and is upset because dad or mom has said this, done this narcissistic thing, and it's how you respond to that that matters. Not how you lecture about their behavior.
No. They don't listen to that. No, they don't listen to that.
Yeah.
So I want to say it a little more harsher than you just, I'm going to say the same thing, but I'm going to say it harsher. If you're worried about the narcissistic parent, the impossible parent on the other side, turning your children into narcissists and fear of that could be a danger, but you could turn your children into narcissists also if you feel powerless in light of the other parent, if you've given away your power to the other parent, if you keep feeling as the victim of the other parent, then you are going to turn your children into narcissists also.
Yes, because that's what we often see in alienating parents.
Yes. So be careful. It's not the victim is also self-focused.
Yes.
The narcissist is also self-focused. And that's why we started this out at the beginning. This is complicated. The real healthy point is who are you?
Right.
And how are you being you? And then how do you model you? How do you model for your children so they can be them?
Yes. And so the last thing I want to mention is in your parenting with these teens, you really have to rein in the social media.
Yes.
Access. There has to be limits on that. One of the things he said that I thought was really interesting was that kids and probably adults too cannot monitor appropriately interpretation of feedback through a screen like they do in person. In other words, when we're in person together, I have a better ability to interpret your feedback of what I just said than if I'm staring at you on a screen, and definitely than if I'm just reading words in a text or a post.
Right? Yes.
That's why texting gets us in trouble, because we don't see body language. We don't hear tone, all of that.
Yeah.
And so encourage your children to go meet their friends somewhere and sit down and talk to one another. Instead of just texting or gaming, the whole gaming thing is really caters to kids that are somewhat shy and reserved and afraid of human interaction. And it almost enables them further to not be able to interpret feedback that they may already be struggling with. I'm thinking of kids, you know, on the spectrum even.
Yeah.
Maybe they're high functioning, but gaming really enables them to not confront and learn what feedback should look like and be like. So that piece alone is enough for me to want to limit social media, but there's so many other things. He called it the echo chamber. Do you remember him talking?
Yes.
About the echo chamber.
Right. It just reinforces itself over and over again.
Yeah. And when you're in that echo chamber, there's nothing in there but self-assessment.
Yeah.
I mean, after a while, there's just, you know, nothing else in your world, but who am I to other people, which is really what the narcissist does, right? They engage in it. They don't engage in self-assessment as much as what does this external thing mean to my internal image. So in some ways, don't let social media parent your child either, because they're going to be a worse parent than your narcissist co-parent.
Indeed.
You know. Yeah.
No, right. The solution, if the problem is too many possibilities, the infiniteness of the possibilities, then the solution is the you. You are the particular, you are the power for your kids. So be you.
Again, I want you to project 10 to 20 years in the future. Your child comes to me and we talk about his or her childhood. And I say, tell me about your parents.
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to tell me about you? And what can you do right now to manage what they tell me about you?
Yeah.
And do you want them to say, because they will say, my dad met all of my needs. He came to all my baseball games. He told everybody I was great, but in private, he tore me down.
Yeah.
He bought me a car when I was 16, but we never went anywhere together in that car. But he was a great dad. Is that going to be enough for you? Do you want them to say, my mom talked trash about my dad all the time? She said we never had anything because he never paid enough, or he left us when we were earlier. He had this other woman. Or is that the narrative that he's going to tell about mom? Or is he going to say, my dad was kind of an a-hole, but my mom helped me put it in perspective.
Right. Yes.
And I still have a relationship with my dad. I've just learned I can't have a deep relationship with my dad because he's not capable of a great relationship with my mom's dad, my grandpa, or Uncle Joe. And, you know, my mom, she's pretty special because she never said one wrong thing about my dad, but she's the one who taught me how to be a good person. And how you answer those questions will determine what you're going to do next.
Indeed.
All right. Cool beans. I hope we don't have to talk about narcissism for a little while again. It always comes up. But
it does. It does.
Yeah. All right, Rick. Good to talk with you. And we'll see everybody next week.
Sounds good. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. Hey, listeners. A new year means a new opportunity to make choices in your child's best interest. However, when a co-parent is abusing alcohol and your kid's safety is at risk, you may feel like you're at a fork in the road, forced to either limit parenting time or allow custodial time to continue, despite the inherent risk. Neither option is desirable, making it, well, a dilemma. Fortunately, there's SoberLink. SoberLink is a high-tech breathalyzer system that sends you instant results of a co-parent's alcohol levels. When your co-parent tests, their identity is automatically confirmed with facial recognition, and tamper sensors ensure no cheating has occurred. You then get instant proof that your kids are safe in their care. So help your family thrive in the new year. Visit www.soberlink.com/dilemmas to learn more and get $50 off your device. The information contained in this podcast is generic. It must not be misconstrued as constituting legal or psychological advice. Decisions relevant to any specific individual, family system, or case require the direct evaluation of skilled, child-centered professionals.